You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
I'm going to hand over now to Luke, who is finishing a doctorate in practical theology at Roehampton and a parish priest in Luton, and whose book is in G-Books called Confounding the Mighty. So also, there's another book. Ours is free, but go and buy his.
You're making me sound like a capitalist now, by the way. Can you all hear me okay? No? I think I'm off at the minute. Please, can you turn me on? There we go. Maybe turn me down. That's what normally happens.
I've just been asked to turn you off.
Wonderful. Many, many years ago, I had a chimney sweep come round to my house to do some work. And having been a bricklayer for 10 years, I always make sure to offer people something to drink when they come round to do work. I can't remember the guy's name, but I do remember he was called the Boxmoor Sweep. Boxmoor is an area near Hemel Hempstead, close to the Bovey Market. Anyone ever been to Bovey Market? It was featured on a Harry Enfield sketch once as the place to get knock-off power tools and scabies. Anyway, so I offered the sweep a cuppa, and he had a very deep and manly voice. And he said, yes, please. And I said, do you have sugar? And he said, no, I'm middle class. Isn't it funny that class stratification is something that's so deeply embedded in British culture and economics and politics that even how we have our tea is seen as a marker of what social class we belong to. Whether it's the two Ronnie sketch, do you remember that one, where the working class man gets a pain in his neck from looking up to the other two, whether it's the predictably terrible media responses to the far-right riots of recent times. The class system in the UK is very much here to stay, and I won't say alive and well, because I don't think it is well, but it is certainly alive. There have been people that have tried to complexify social class beyond the three typical categories of working class, middle class and upper class. Actually, there was a study in 2011 called the Great British Class Survey that suggested, I think, that there were now seven social classes in Great Britain, ranging from the elite down to the precariat. But we're not just here today to talk about class. The theme of today's sessions are church. I personally was brought up attending a little Methodist church, and I left as soon as I was old enough to make the choice. I didn't return to church till I was about 16, when I had a conversion experience in a tiny little Baptist chapel in Buckinghamshire, and then ended up in the youth group of an Anglican church plant that met in a school. I later was a youth worker in a Pentecostal church as well, so I've really done the rounds. I can remember, particularly in the Anglican church, some of the people who preached and visited seemed very different to me. They spoke in a very different way to the way that people in my family spoke, seemed to have very different lives. I was lucky, though, that we had a very down-to-earth vicar. Nick the Vic, his name was. But over time, I started to realise that I really didn't feel like I fit in church, as desperately as I tried. I sort of started to get the sense there was something wrong with me. I just wasn't really like the nice church kids. I liked different music, different TV, and saw the world differently somehow. And this was something that only increased over the years of my life as I drifted into ministry and then back out again pretty quickly, realizing that my face did not fit the pipeline of people that the church takes seriously. The only time in my life I ever really felt like I fit in a Christian group was when I joined the God Squad Motorcycle Club. For the first time, I was around a group of people who were like me, did the sort of job that I did, spoke like me, looked like me. In fact, some of them thought I was probably a bit posh and too well educated. But I found it quite intoxicating after so long to find my tribe. Having more fundamentalist beliefs back in those days I was inspired by my mate Sean Stillman and the club's founder John Smith. Anyone been going to Greenbelt for long enough to have heard John Smith preach back in the day? God rest you, John. They kind of convinced me about this idea of training for ministry. And so, believing that everything would be okay, I gave up my bricklaying business. I started studying theology with CMS back in 2014, and we sold our house and moved into central Luton. My wife Jenny had been working with a charity in Luton that supports sex workers, and we sort of found ourselves strangely falling in love with the town. And we moved in to do that thing that keen young Christians do, to try and make a difference. My wife's experience of working with those women was another very classed experience. My wife got her first GCSE a couple of years ago. She comes from a family of bricklayers. But most of the other volunteers of that charity were nice, polite, middle-class church folk from a suburb south of Luton that we call Harpenden. Anyone from Hertfordshire will get that joke. And a lot of the people couldn't understand why she had such a good rapport with these street-working women. We're actually still in touch with quite a few all these years later. And it was very simple why she had such a good rapport. She didn't believe that she was any better than them. She did her best work going outside the nice drop-in to have a fag and chat with the girls in the street and just talk about life. Through the experiences of that time, that's 10 years ago now, almost exactly, 2014, two things really surprised me. The first thing that surprised me, having not had the best time at school, was when I started studying theology, I was surprisingly good at it and got quite good marks, which came as a bit of a shock. Not bad for the guy voted most likely to go to prison in his class at school. The second thing that surprised me was, despite that completely bonkers type of ministry I was involved in at the time, I was working with people who are homeless, young people being exploited by gangs, outlaw bikers. We were working with people in the sex trade. It still felt like church people just didn't take me seriously. In fact, on the rare occasions that I was ever invited to say anything about my work, I felt more like a sort of sideshow freak at a circus than someone whose opinion was particularly respected. But over time, I got a bit more involved in the Anglican Church and the local deanery in the diocese, and that started to change a little bit. And on one occasion, I was invited to the Dean's house at St Albans Cathedral for a strategy meeting. And so when I went riding in on my big old Triumph motorbike in my club colours and my well-oiled jeans, you can just imagine the looks on people's faces as I rode over that nice little cobbled street. And the great joy it gave me when people said, "What on earth are you doing here?" And I said, "I've come for a meeting at the Dean's house." And after that meeting, my good mate Father Eddie Green took me out for a cheeky Nando's. I believe St Albans Cathedral is the closest cathedral to a Nando's anywhere in the country. And that was where Father Eddie popped the question. And he asked me if I'd ever thought about training to be a priest. And my response was to laugh in his face and tell him there's no way the C of E would ever ordain somebody like me. In the words of Alan Partridge, needless to say, he had the last laugh. Well, that was until a short time after that when I was invited to give a presentation to the bishop's staff, and that was featured in the annual report that was presented to the diocese alongside a nice photo of me similarly attired to when I went to the Dean's house. And I'm told that when the report was received at diocesan synod, a question was asked by one clergyman who, pointing at the photo of me, asked, "What on earth has some tattooed ruffian leaning against a motorcycle got to do with ministry in the Church of England?" I'm told the bishop shot him down in flames. But I could bore you all day with stories like that of ignorant things that the middle class and upper class dominated church people have said to me over the years. There was a vicar who told me when I was appointed to a job that he'd warned the congregation about what I look like before I started the job. I was quite good looking when I was younger as well. But frankly, I find talking about all of those many, many, many stories of daft things people have said a bit boring. Because what I want to talk about today has very little to do with what system of categorisation we apply to different social classes in Britain, whether it's one or seven or however many. And actually it has equally little to do with the identity aspect of social class as well. That's one of the reasons why I've provocatively titled this session Why the Church Shouldn't Include Working Class People. Because focusing on the specifics of stratification is not something I really care about, nor indeed are the cultural markers, such as how much sugar people have in their tea. For the record, I don't have sugar in my tea. My mates on the building site always said I should be a foreman because of that. But what I am really interested in talking about and asking questions about are the political, the ethical, and the theological questions about class, and how I believe class consciousness ought to affect every single thing which churches do. Everything. And I say that unapologetically, because at the risk of class reductionism, I want to suggest that every one of the key issues that we face in society today and across the world is somehow touched by class. Not just class from the British perspective of working middle and upper, but in view of the working or the labouring classes of the whole world, the vast majority of whom, of course, are neither white nor British. And I'm keen to ask what role we will play in our planet's increasingly fragile future. Last year, I put together this edited volume, which brings together 9 diverse working class voices to reflect on church, class, and solidarity. And I would have loved it if I could have had all 9 of us here today, because the reality is that each one of us that contributed to that book have had a very different experience of social class because of the different parts of ourselves, our gender, our sexuality, our ethnicity. But also we've experienced a lot in common too, and I think that comes out in the book. So I hope to capture some of what I learned from the experience of putting this book together and the many years of church and class struggle that have made up my life. There's 3 basic ideas that I want to share with you that I believe pinpoint 3 things that churches need to do if they want to get serious about tackling poverty and they want to get serious about social class. The first of those things is material analysis. I think we need to stop pontificating so much in churches, and we need to learn to do some serious material analysis of the material lives of poor and working class people. What is actually happening at a material level in people's lives? This means we need to give up a lot of what we think we know about the lives of poor and working class people. We need to give up a lot of what we think we have to offer to people as well. We often talk about the poor and the marginalised in church circles, but even combining those 2 words is something I think we need to address, because the poor labouring masses of the world are not a minority. They are the majority of people who live on this planet. They are not the outsider in our story. They are the centre of gravity in the world. Wealth inequality, both here and across the whole world, has been growing at an absolutely insane rate in the last 2 centuries. The gap between the rich and the poor has become not a gap, but a chasm, whereby now the richest 1% of people control 50% of the world's wealth. Trickle-down economics is not working. All of the wealth is flowing upstream to the 1%. Earlier I said that almost all the pressing issues in the world today are touched by social class. Let's take possibly the biggest issue, climate change. Did you know that the richest 10% of people in the world account for 50% of all carbon emissions? According to Oxfam, it would take 1,500 years from someone in the bottom 99% to produce as much carbon as someone in the top 1%. And as we know, climate change and its associated impacts, disaster, disease, unrest, by far affect the poor people of the world the most. But even just focusing on individuals is not enough. Out of the whole world, there are 100 businesses who are responsible for 71% of greenhouse gas emissions. Indeed, there are companies now which have bigger turnovers than the GDP of some smaller countries. So we're talking about a very small group of people and businesses having a tremendous amount of impact on the world. I spoke at a theology conference recently. I'm laughing. This is what I do when I'm being naughty. I get a little laugh and a smile. Emily, one of my students, knows. I spoke at a theology conference recently where a very noted and respected theologian suggested that what we really need to do is, if everyone in the room could get their bank statement each month and get a red, a yellow and a green highlighter and just go through all of our spending and mark it like red, yellow or green for how ethical our consumption was, if everybody could just do that, that would change the world, and what was the phrase that she used? Redeem capitalism. If we all just could do a traffic light system on our bank statements, we could redeem capitalism. Come with me, and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. No one knows that one. Oh, shame. You don't watch as many memes on Twitter as me, clearly. That is some of the most nonsense I've ever heard in my entire life. You can't fix what we are in by making minor adjustments to the spending patterns of middle-class people. In fact, any minor adjustments to live a more pious middle-class life are not going to fix the mess that we are in the world. Are there any Terry Pratchett fans in the room? Yeah, I thought I was with a home crowd here. Is anyone familiar with the Boots theory of socioeconomic unfairness? It's one of the most genius pieces of economic writing ever. It bears quoting in full. This is from the book Men at Arms by Terry Pratchett. There's a reason that the rich were so rich, Vimes reasoned, because they managed to spend less money. Take Boots, for example. He earned $38 a month plus allowances. A really good pair of leather boots costs $50, but an affordable pair of boots, which was sort of okay for a season or two, and then leaked like hell when the cardboard gave out, cost about $10. Those were the kinds of boots that Vimes always bought, and wore until the soles were so thin that he could tell where he was in Ankh-Morpork on a foggy night by the feel of the cobbles. But the thing was that good boots lasted for years and years. A man who could afford $50 had a pair of boots that would still be keeping his feet dry in 10 years' time, while the poor man could only afford cheap boots and would have spent $100 on boots in the same time and would still have wet feet. Do you have any idea how expensive it is to be poor? I recently supported a family in my parish who'd been made homeless due to a combination of being made redundant and the rogue landlord who owned the hovel they were renting until mushrooms started growing out of the walls and the ceiling fell on them in the middle of the night due to the level of damp. Almost every shred of their possessions and furniture was destroyed. And so they were placed in temporary accommodation by the local council in a hotel. Now, this family were relatively recent arrivals in the UK, and this is just the sort of story that the Honourable MP for Clacton, Nigel Farage, would be turning pink in the face about. Foreigners! Coming here! Taking our jobs and claiming benefits! I've never known how people manage to do both of those things at the same time. Living in a hotel! I wouldn't mind living in a hotel every day. Well, you might not, but the kind of hotel that people like Nigel Farage and, as we've seen, my fellow Lutonian Tommy Robinson frequent is probably not the same sort of hotel that this family was staying in. Parents and people with caring responsibilities, I want you to imagine for a minute. You've got 5 kids and mum staying with you, and you're stuck across 2 rooms in a bed and breakfast where you're not allowed to make any noise, you're not allowed to cook your own food. Breakfast is not served until 8 a.m. in the morning. But your five children have been put in five different schools across the town, so you have to get up at 5 a.m. to get them ready for the several hours long walk to get each of them to their school on time. And that's because the car has broken down, and you can't afford to get the car fixed because of all the parking tickets you've got from the hotel car park where you're having to stay. And you can't afford to pay off the parking tickets because you have to get takeaways or eat in a restaurant if you want your children to have a hot meal, because you're not allowed to cook in the hotel. But you can't afford to buy a meal in a restaurant or a takeaway for the whole family, so you go hungry, making sure that the kids get to eat. And then you face the prospect of walking several hours again to collect the kids from school with an empty stomach. So you decided to stick a couple of croissants from the breakfast buffet in a bag when you get back from the school run. And you have the indignity of being accused of stealing from the hotel by the receptionist in front of all the other guests, who, by the way, get their sheets and towels changed a lot more often than you do, even though the hotel's getting paid the same amount of money. And then you have to suddenly walk halfway across the town again, because the council phoned you and said if you weren't at the town hall for a housing meeting within the hour, they would find you voluntarily homeless, and you'd have to move out of that hotel room by midday the next day. Now, forgetting for a moment the super rich and the huge companies, even some of the moderately wealthy have done quite well out of this situation. The car parking company have done all right out of it. The hotel have done all right out of it. The managers at the council, who are just doing their jobs and following policy, they've done all right out of it. The restaurants, the self-storage company where all their stuff is slowly festering. If you're not immensely pissed off by stories like this, then friends, I would suggest the love of God is not within you. This is just one of many, 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 many stories I could tell you of how our society is not only failing the most vulnerable people, but is actually leeching off of them. The small town I once ministered in had a homelessness sector, or rather industry, which was worth multiple million pounds a year. And yet none of the excellent top flight CEOs on good salaries, which charities of course need to be able to function, did a single thing to address any of the root causes which led to the epidemic of homelessness in that town. None of them would speak up and challenge the unfair policies of the local council or the housing developers who were not doing their part. And when a few of us did start asking those sorts of questions in the public questions section of the council housing meeting, people were incensed and they called us aggressive, confrontational and unfair. I guess only certain members of the public are allowed to ask certain types of questions in a democratic meeting. Some of my colleagues remarked at the time that words might be heard from the window of the mayor's office. Will no one rid me of that troublesome priest? At the time, I was the trustee of a little housing advocacy charity that was on average getting someone housed for every £200 of budget that we spent, a minuscule fraction of what a lot of the other charities were spending. And the person that set up that organisation used to tell a story and say, if an alien came to planet Earth and looked at this whole situation, stories like the one I told you a minute ago, the only logical conclusion they could come to is that we are farming homeless people for money. I think this is some of what Dom Helder Camara meant when he said the words, I feed the poor and they call me a saint. I ask why they are poor and they call me a communist. From recent experience, I'd add a third thing onto that. I organise with the poor and they call the police. we were to conduct some real material analysis of the lives of poor and working class people in this country, across the world, of the struggle of our planet to survive, in our churches, in our HQs and diocesan offices, God forbid, even in our theological colleges, I think we could only come to one possible conclusion. And that's that the church's approach to poverty and social class must not be one of inclusion, but one of justice. Now, I've been talking about this stuff for a very long time, and I've noticed that recently people are just starting to talk about class a little bit more in church and theology circles. Books are being written which talk about how we need to get more working class people into church if we are to be really inclusive. The diversity and inclusion statements of some of the theological guilds and other organisations have started to refer to socio-economic background, and even on vanishingly rare occasions, refer to people's class. Some of my colleagues are even making great efforts to try to make training for leadership in churches more inclusive to people from backgrounds like mine. But I don't think this is enough. Actually, that's what I refer to as feckless faith in my book, because it's a type of faith which only ever sees working class people as people over there, people outside the inside circle and the central narrative. At worst, people for whom we have something to offer, and at best, people who might have something to offer us. But none of this changes or challenges the fact that we're living under a political economy where those higher up the class stratification are literally killing the poor and killing the planet by the way they live, the way they conduct business, the way they conduct government. So far, I've only really talked about material analysis of what's right in front of us, but we can do a bit of historical material analysis too, to see how we ended up in the mess that we're in. And having done a bit of this recently, I'm afraid to say that churches didn't exactly come out smelling of roses. For a recent research project, I looked at the history of land ownership in the UK and how that relates to social class. I think thinking about land is really essential for thinking about class, because the means of producing wealth and a place to live, of course, always reverts back to land. Indeed, the impact of the last few centuries of political economy has literally changed and scarred the face of the lands upon which people live. The very birth of our classed system in the UK has its origins in land ownership laws. What's been happening to Palestine since the 1940s is about land. Even the invention of the humble lawnmower has its roots in the relationship between land and class. And if you want to know why, ask me later in the questions. Over the last few hundred, well, several hundred years really, common lands double the size of Wales have been seized into private ownership through parliamentary land enclosure acts, under the guise of making farming more productive. In fact, the land upon which you are now sitting was seized into private land ownership through such an enclosure. How do you think these people got these great big estates and great big houses? You think they worked for that? Countless people who lived, worked, and grazed their livestock on lands just like this were forced into vagrancy and tenant farming, which enriched the landowners and crushed those who worked the land. Those who didn't work and roamed around those once free lands, which had no fences and borders, were seen as children of Belial, as one Anglican minister put it. If you were caught outside your own parish, you could be punished with a lashing or an inch-wide hole being borne into your cartilage of your ear. A second offence could mean death or being shipped out to Virginia to work in forced labour on a plantation. Now, those who are listening closely might recognise here something of a pattern of what has emerged. in terms of the exploitation of land and labour, which of course later emerged and continues on a global scale through colonialism. Numerous scholars, including good old Uncle Karl Marx, saw this process as the very birth of both capitalism and colonialism. I've noticed, by the way, it's really fun to say the words Karl Marx when you give a talk, because you can guarantee that at least one person in the questions will have forgotten every single other thing that you say and just latch on to the fact that you said the words Karl Marx, which is funny, as if it disqualifies anything else that you've got to say because you used a little bit of Marxist political analysis. When I used to use a Haynes manual to change the oil on my old Triumph, no one called me a Haynesist. But yet we've got a pretty solid set of tools for doing a bit of political economical analysis, and people freak out about it. There's so much more that could be said about all of this, particularly in how the churches, especially the Church of England, gained a huge proportion of their wealth and their power through their complicity in all this, both at home and in the colonial mission fields. But there's little time now. I've written a chapter for a book that's coming out from SCM Press soon called Development and Decolonisation. Lots of other scholars from around the world writing interesting stuff too, so do look out for that. So I said I had 3 points I wanted you to take away. The first, what was the first? Anyone remember? The first was material analysis. Let's do some material analysis. Let's stop talking about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. The second is justice. I think we need to move away from those narratives of inclusion to thinking about poverty and class as justice issues. Any cursory reading of the Old and New Testaments also makes that quite clear. We can read the minor prophets like Amos, who cried against God's people, "Away with the sound of your songs, but let justice roll like a river." The example of what the anointing of God's Spirit means in Isaiah, and quoted by Jesus. Good news to who? Not Elon Musk, the oppressed. Liberty to the captives, release to prisoners, and a day of vengeance. Good luck getting invited back when you use words like that. We've got the Song of Mary, where she outlined what her son's ministry would mean, casting down the mighty from their thrones and lifting up the lowly, sending the rich away empty and filling the poor with good things. I think it's a cruel irony that we repeat those words every day in evening prayer in the Church of England and never really seem to live out their implications. When you quote verses like these, you often get accused of doing radical theology or liberation theology. I just thought I was reading the Bible. So if we recognise then that the class divisions in our society and across the world are the result of exploitation and oppression by those in the upper classes, if we see that our political economy exploits land and labour for exponentially increasing wealth for the few, half killing our planet in the process, if we observe the very material impact of all of this on the health and the well-being of everybody who is not doing well out of the system. And by the way, my middle class comrades, that's going to be you too one day. It stops making any sense to talk about including working class people. Why on earth would you want to include people in something that's killing them? Why would we celebrate a diversity that is built on the exploitation of some by others? Invite a rabbit and a wolf to a meeting and talk about diversity, and the rabbit's not going to thank you. From both a practical and a theological perspective, it really makes no sense to celebrate class diversity. It only makes sense for the church, or churches, to make her mission to work towards a classless society. There are a few Christian organisations over the years who've purported to do this. Last time I checked, I don't know if it still is, but it was one of the charitable aims of the organisation Christians on the Left, to work towards a classless society. Ooh, that's a bit radical, isn't it? I'm not, however, convinced that the current centre-left Labour government are going to be the people to get us there. So what do we do then? I believe that we need to get organised. Now, I'm going to make some people feel really, really old, and some people think I'm really, really old here. But can I just have a show of hands? How many people here came of age around the time of the millennium? So, born between 1980 and 1985. Anybody? Oh, wow, this is going to bomb really hard. I'm conscious of the fact that I came from a probably quite upwardly mobile working class family and being white as well. But those who were around at that time, do you remember feeling a little bit more hopeful about the world back then? Do you remember how some of us thought the internet was going to somehow like democratise everything and mean education and information for all? Some of you might remember going to Christian camps and singing songs like, I'm going to be a history maker in this land. Yeah, you're probably on antidepressants like me as well. I didn't need a show of hands for that one, but shout out to my sertraline crew. I've learned from bitter experience that if you want to get invited back to speak at events, you're supposed to end on a really positive note. And so making people feel like they're going to change the world is the way to do it, like my friend with their bank statements and highlighters. But I'm sorry, I'm an elder emo, so I just really like things that are depressing. But I'll be honest, I don't really feel that same kind of hope anymore that felt like it was kind of in the air back then. Things just aren't really looking all that great at the moment, are they? I mean, if I'm the only one, that's fine, but half my Christian heroes from back in the day are either embroiled in scandals or have become $300 an hour deconstruction coaches. Like, what happened? But there is one thing which does give me a little glimmer of hope. It's one thing that keeps me believing instead of giving up my dog collar and going back to the building site. And good God, that would be horrific now that I'm so old and lazy. It's seeing the little glimmer of light that emerges when people get organised together around a common aim of justice. When people really come together in a local, a grassroots context to start thinking about how they can tackle problems together in hope of a better world. I used to be a bit of an optimist when I was younger. I don't really know what happened, but I often say one of my core beliefs is not that a better world is coming, but that a better world is definitely possible. And it's kind of up to us, really. From my own academic research with Christian community organisers, that's really where I see the spirit emerging, like tender shoots coming out from the spring ground. It's like God's breath breathing into the space between people when they really see each other and develop this sense of common cause. Like the Jewish mystics believe, these little bits of the Shekinah glory of God that are kind of hidden around and sometimes come alive. Did you know our evolutionary ability to organise in large numbers is what made us the dominant species on this planet? And it might possibly help us undo some of the mess that we've made. On the wall in my vicarage office, I've got a picture of Chairman Fred Hampton of the Black Panther Party, and I keep it up when the bishop comes round as well. He's got used to me now. But Fred Hampton was a truly remarkable organiser. Chairman Fred helped create what became known as a Rainbow Coalition. He united the Black Panthers with street gangs like the Latin Kings, the white working class Appalachian Young Patriots, as they were called, and they really came together. These were groups that were at war with each other on the streets, and they came together in common cause. And you see, that's where I think those of us on the left side of the house have so catastrophically failed in recent generations, because we've forgotten how to build a broad base. We've forgotten how to organise together, particularly with working class people. For his young years, I think Chairman Fred saw things with some startling clarity. Firstly, he got the difference between inclusion and revolution. He used to tell this story and say, if I took you to the doors of a quarantine ward in a hospital and it had a big sign saying, quarantine, do not enter. And I said, you know what, I really think we should go in and make that quarantine ward a lot more diverse and inclusive than it is at the moment. You'd say I was a delinquent leader. Because that's what we're doing when we try to include the majority of people in the world in the status quo, whether that's in the church or in politics or whatever. As my co-authors in the book and as my friends Sharon and Alex will share in here later on, the church can be a really toxic place for poor and working class people. Some of us are going to share some of our experiences at 3:30. I've experienced a lot of that myself firsthand. But Fred saw quite clearly a way ahead. He said we've got to face facts that we're in a class struggle, whether we like it or not. He said we're not going to fight fire with fire. You've got to fight fire with water. You don't fight racism with racism, but with solidarity. You don't fight capitalism with black capitalism, or I might add, pink capitalism or green capitalism or any other kind of capitalism. You fight it with socialism. You fight it with the power of people. And that's all that these, when we say these words like Karl Marx, socialism, people get all freaked out about it, like the boogeyman's going to get you. We're just talking about people having power. It's really all we're talking about. Yeah, okay, those words have been exploited and appropriated by some pretty nasty people. But we're really just talking about giving people power to make decisions over what happens in their own lives. So fighting with solidarity, I think, means getting organised. The old timers used to say there were three steps to winning social change. Educate, agitate, and organise. And I think they might have been onto something. Contrary to what some people who want to be more inclusive to the working class might say, I think moving past education is a mistake. Trying to make it easier for people to fit in by not talking about important stuff doesn't seem like a great idea to me. If we don't educate our future leaders, how are they going to educate anybody else? And I mean the kind of education that Paulo Freire talked about, the kind of education that liberates people. I have to say that for all that the Church of England has inflicted on me over the years, they paid for an education which liberated me, which I found deeply empowering. I sometimes think they might want to ask for a refund, but it has been really empowering to get an education I never would have been able to get otherwise. And Christians have been organising for popular education for a very, very, very long time. Could look at the example of the socialist Sunday schools that Eve Parker writes about in her chapter in the book. Could look at the liberation movements in Latin America. Can look at the band and class meetings of early Methodism before it went institutional. Let's not forget, friends, that faith groups played a huge role in the formation of the Chartism, the labour movement, and suffrage in this country. And forming spaces for mutual education is absolutely key. We've got to get rid of these ideas that just because people have been marginalised, it means they have all the answers you're looking for. I think there can be dangers in the lived experience model if we're not careful. I bet a lot of people in those disgusting far-right riots that happened would say they had some lived experience too. But they hadn't been educated in the material truth of things. There's a major role, I think, for our theological education establishments here. Imagine if our theology colleges went from being like a finishing school for middle-class clergy into training and empowering both lay and ordained people and just people in the community on how to do organising for change in their local contexts. What a great education for ministry that would be. And then the final one, agitation, which is the part that the nice church folk really don't like. if I had a pound for every time I've been called words like political or confrontational or whatever, because I want to help people win the change that they need to survive, I'd probably be in the top 1% myself. It might help us to look at people like Moses, the minor prophets, Mary, Jesus, Paul, Francis and Claire, Dorothy Day, Martin Luther King. All these people were agitators. They agitated for change. Thank goodness Twitter wasn't around in those days. They got off their asses and did something. Motivated people. If there's one really big enemy to change in our time, I'd have to say it's apathy. I think people are just burned out and wrung out and tired out. And at the risk of joining the tinfoil hat brigade, I'd say that's probably by design. Or at least it's a very happy coincidence for the powerful that we're all so exhausted, we've got no fight left in us. One of the questions that broad-based community organisers often ask, the person who taught me, Hannah, was here a minute ago. One of the questions they often ask is, what is making you angry? When was the last time someone asked that question in your PCC or church council? That's the thing that we don't talk about, right? It's hilarious to watch people squirm when you ask that question. We just don't really do anger in the church, do we? It's too uncomfortable. My friend, good friend Anu Palmer, who's a theologian, talks about rage in her theology around climate change. And she said, yeah, people get really upset about it. And she's like, what else are you going to get enraged about other than the fact that the planet's dying, man? The other thing that's coming out of my research with organisers is that many see the Spirit of God as the prime agitator. The Spirit of God is the one who turns simple encounters between people and agitates them into something special. The one who leaves people after situations of injustice, like the one I described earlier, thinking, I just can't let this go. I can't stop thinking about this. I can't sleep. We have to do something about this together. And then finally, organising. One of the things I love hearing about in the interviews and focus groups I've been doing in my research, and from the parishioners and friends that we meet in my parish in Luton, is the amazing changes that happen when people just start to gather together, particularly when it's with groups of people they wouldn't normally mix with. There's an opening of horizons that happens for people when we spend some deep time together with people who are different to us and where we have a shared purpose, where we want to actually do something together. There's a long-running joke about how every interfaith meeting is not complete unless someone's eaten a samosa. And actually, do you know what? I've found getting out and doing stuff with people of other faiths is far more effective for developing real friendships than eating samosas, but I do like samosas, so. I think we need to move beyond the people that sing about how I'm going to be a history maker. You're not going to do anything. Really upset people when I said that at the end of that talk I was talking about, because they were kind of psyched about doing their bank statements, and they said, well, what have you got to offer us to do? I was like, I don't know. What the hell are you asking me for? You can't do anything on your own. I can't do anything on my own. It's just not how change works. When people come together, that's how change happens. When people come together in numbers, that's how big change happens. All the history books favour the charismatic leaders, but actually it's people who change the world for better or for worse. If churches, if theology colleges, if Christian parachurch organisations and others really saw value in setting aside significant time and resources to organise with other people who want to change their communities, people of all faiths and none, who might just be touched by the breath of the Spirit too. Just imagine what a force for change we could be together. If we started to listen to the things that people in our parishes or circuits or neighbourhoods care about and started working together on some solutions, just imagine what would be possible. If we stopped patting ourselves on the back for fishing people out of the river and work out who pushed them in, who had the contract for maintaining the fence, who stole the life jackets. Just imagine what we could do. In the book, we share a few different practical approaches to what this might look like. So I know a lot of people like a little positive tip at the end. And we look specifically at education programmes, employment, broad-based organising for a living wage. We've just got the NHS to sign up to become a living wage employer across our region. Trades union involvement. I'm a member of Unite the Union. Go and check them out if you're here today and you're a faith worker. Friends that have set up worker cooperatives, all sorts of things. In my own experience, I've seen council housing policies change, inhospitable immigrant accommodation panned, and big employers start paying a fair wage, when really quite surprisingly small numbers of people get together and are committed to make a change. I can't tell you what the right thing to do in your neighbourhood is because I don't live there. Only you and your neighbours know that. But I really, really do believe that the sort of change that comes up from the ground is the kind of change that lasts. So in closing, I just want to challenge you. If you're really serious about poverty, if you're really serious about class justice, when you get back from this festival, see if you can get 10 or 20 people in a room from your neighbourhood. The more outspoken and annoying they are, the better, because those are the people who get things done. Not just the usual suspects, but a diverse group of people. And start talking about change together over a cup of tea, even a samosa if you like. Start asking people in your neighbourhood what makes them angry. Start dreaming about what kind of community you could have. Start learning how to educate, agitate and organise together. Get some training. One of the things that I really respect about the Trussell Trust is that they've started to encourage people to dream much bigger than food banks, which are such an important part of what so many churches do. Bigger than debt advice programmes, as useful as they are, and to start dreaming about real change. So go home, get some people together, and dream on with people in your community, and make your dreams be big. Thank you. I think we've got time for a few questions, have we?
Just super. Grabbing a mic. So, yeah, a couple of questions, two or three. Hands up. I'm going to fall over if I jump down there. Anyone? It's a big crowd. You said it all, Luke.
I do talk too much.
There we go. They're coming. I'm going to go you and then pass in the white.
Excellent talk.
Thank you.
How does the gospel of Jesus Christ then impact on you? And is it because of the gospel that you are where you are today? I mean, you've touched on elements where it sounds like you could just want to politicize some things. And you answered that question really as part of your talk, and you don't want that to happen. But how much has Jesus driven everything you're doing?
That's a really, really good question, because it entirely depends which Jesus we're talking about. And the kind of Jesus that you see in most churches, with his lovely hair and his pale complexion and the kind of stained glass windows that you had in the previous church where I worked, which sort of depicted him almost looking like some kind of Roman Caesar, that kind of Jesus doesn't really do it for me anymore. But when you start to apply some of that material analysis to the life of Christ, you gain a historical understanding of what was going on. The fact that he was a worker whose labour was being exploited in the building of great big settlements for the Romans who were occupying land, exploiting workers. Then his teachings start to take on a bit of a different tone. And so when my faith has been at its absolute weakest many, many times, there's still something about Jesus for me. And it might just be that reading his teachings and his life, I would say that the gospel is deeply, deeply political. especially when read in the context of the time. I read a great book a few years ago that it was just called Jesus, A Life in Class Conflict, and it went into some really good historical material analysis of what was happening. It wasn't written from a particularly religious perspective, but really fascinating to look at. So yeah, I would say, you know, when Mary said that Jesus's life was going to be about casting the mighty down from their thrones, I think she really meant it. I don't think that was meant to be metaphorical, and we can read so much about his life in the same way.
Hi, Luke.
Good to see you, comrade.
Thank you. You quoted at one point what we call the Messianic Manifesto, Jesus in Luke 4, quoting Isaiah, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me. I noticed that you, if I got it right, used the Isaiah words at the end and the year of vengeance, which Jesus doesn't use. Yeah. And I'm guessing there's probably a reason he doesn't.
Yes.
Later on, you talked about the place of anger, which I get. So just some reflections on anger that's appropriate, what vengeance means, anger that takes us to the wrong places, because I struggle with that.
That's such a good question, and I struggle with it too. And I think the other thing you have to talk about alongside anger is violence. You know, a lot of people would say that the liberation of working class people can only come through violence. In fact, I've quoted Fred Hampton from the Black Panther Party. You know, they armed themselves and saw violence. And the thing that keeps me a Christian is I really want to believe that change without that kind of physical violence is possible. I think change by its very nature is a kind of a violent thing in a way, in a certain sense of the word. But I really, really, really want to believe that positive change without violence is possible. And I think that there are different types of anger as well. There's an anger that can just eat you up and consume you and make you we've all probably got union comrades that we've met in different TUC meetings and things that you just think, God, you're so angry, it's exhausting to be around you. So I think there's a balance in all of this. I would say in church circles, we probably are a bit too much away from thinking about the kind of how traumatic change can be and how anger is a part of that. But definitely you can go too far the other way. And I think that is exactly why Jesus takes out that word vengeance. Is if you look at John Dominic Crossan writes some really interesting things about the difference between John the Baptist and Jesus, and he sort of depicts John the Baptist as being a bit more of an out and out kind of revolutionary type character, and his suggestion is Jesus sees his mate with his head on a plate and thinks, well, maybe that's not the way to win, you know. That's an interesting perspective that I quite like. But yeah, really good question, thank you. Brilliant.
You talk quite a lot about how, like, changing the church on a local basis, but also how the church thing needs to fundamentally change. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's currently possible? And cause it seems that for the foreseeable future for me, because the church, Church of England is, and theologically and organisationally, still run by a handful of sort of Oxbridge graduates, mostly the youngest of is in their 60s.
Yeah.
Do you think that's possible if that's the case, or do you think that needs to fundamentally change as well?
Oh yeah, sure. How can I say something that won't get me CDM'd? I think we need change really badly. I think that's going to be extremely difficult, and I don't expect it to happen anytime soon. I think it's worth hanging in there, otherwise I wouldn't be doing the job that I do. But I think that kind of change is going to be hard, and I think if you look at some of the kind of real inspirational characters through the Church of England's history, they were often people that weren't especially popular with the powers that be. That said, it is a broad ship, the Church of England, and actually I'm sort of pleasantly surprised that there is a place for somebody like me. I'm very lucky. My area bishop is brilliant, and very passionate about justice and really supportive, and he's gone to bat for me a few times when I've got my fingers too close to the fire. So yeah, I think it's tough to imagine major change anytime soon. I think we'll be forced into change in the coming years, because I think we're at the edge of a precipice. If we didn't have 10 billion quid sitting in the bank, we'd be in real trouble. What we do with that is another big question, because it seems like a lot of that wasn't obtained through particularly legitimate means. So who knows? Who knows where we'll be in 10, 20 years' time? But I think it'll only change for the better if there's good people still involved. I mean, I think the whole conversation around LGBTQ inclusion in the church at the moment the nature of the conversation is just so depressing that we're still going round and round and round in circles. You know, felt like we had a vote and it was agreed. Like, I don't know. I think a bit more democracy in the church would certainly help in terms of how people are appointed, even. Good tune.
Have you got one question over there? Come on, then.
Make it short. I'll save you the context. Are there examples that you've seen of churches in richer areas or the richer churches doing a really good job of not including the working class people, but like actually, you know, serving, doing, as you said, the turning upside down, that we could learn from?
I've certainly met individuals, and I think one thing that people sometimes get wrong in what I'm trying to say, in my family, whenever class was talked about, my dad always used to say, you are what you're born. You're only ever going to be what you're born. You're born working class. That's what you'll be for the rest of your life. I don't expect somebody who's from a middle or an upper class background to pretend that that's not their background. In fact, I think you'll find working class people mostly will get on with anybody who's genuine and authentic. It's just about what you do with the power and the privilege and whatever resources that you have. So I think it is certainly possible for churches. I'm trying to think of some concrete examples. If I'm honest, I've mostly seen kind of individuals. I mean, I myself was the kind of archetypal right-leaning white van man, and it was through encounter with people who were different to me that I changed my perspective. And I think that's possible for anybody. I really do. I mean, I think people can change, and I think the most important thing is just being willing to listen, being willing to let go of your prejudice and create spaces where people's voices can be heard. And actually, when you do that, I think no matter what background you come from, when you discover the lives that a lot of people are living in this supposedly developed nation, it's going to shock you in one or another way. It really is. So that, I think, is the most important thing.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.